Hello and welcome to the Bitcoin with Jake show. Today I've got James Lavish. Welcome, James.
How are you, Jake? Glad to be here and thank you for having me.
No, absolute pleasure. I'm delighted you've taken the time to come and join me. So we're going to talk all about Bitcoin, unsurprisingly, and particularly personal journeys and what's brought us to today. So starting at the top, could you briefly introduce yourself and the projects you're involved in at the moment? And we'll then more than likely take a step back a decade or more to find out how you got to that point.
Yeah. So I'm James Lavish, and I am fairly new to Bitcoin for, you know, some of those OGs out there. I came to the space about a year ago, but I do understand how important Bitcoin is in particular. As far as my background is concerned, generally, I'm an institutional investor. I've been doing, I've been an institutional investor for over 25 years in hedge funds and private equity and a little bit of venture capital. I've traded risk arb, risk, what we call merger arbitrage, anything from convertible debt to distressed debt. I've done a lot of different type of trading and investing over the years. And most recently, I've been the COO of a hedge fund private equity unit that I am actually I'm leaving and going to do something else. And there are a few things on the horizon that I'm super excited about, all involved with Bitcoin in some way or another. Some of them mining, some of them in education. And one of them in education. And as you know, I've been working on a newsletter, and I love being on Twitter in particular. I'm not a big social media guy, never have been. And I got onto Twitter about 5 or 6 months ago, and I've really enjoyed meeting so many people in the Bitcoin community. And, you know, being one of the voices that can be out there and help people learn about Bitcoin, especially from my background, which is definitely different than most people in this space. So it's been a good journey so far.
Well, Bitcoin's delighted to have someone with your pedigree, shall we say, in the investment space coming and joining. It's fascinating that people like yourselves are being essentially sucked into what this social movement almost is. Before we dive into those extra topics of today, so 25 years ago, you kicked off as an investor. Tell me a bit about that. So, you know, how old were you at the time? Where were you? Why was it that you wanted to get into investing? What had been going on in your life at the time?
Well, I mean, like everybody wants to be in a hedge fund when they're like 5 or 6 years old, right? So that was me. No.
I thought you were being serious for a second. I was like, do they?
No, I mean, if we go all the way back to college, Some of my listeners may know, and you may know already, that I was a hockey player, and I played hockey in college, ice hockey, and I was at Yale and playing ice hockey and having the time of my life. You know, it was the best time of my life, and hockey was going really well. I had been drafted by the Boston Bruins. I was on the U.S. national team, which is kind of the Olympic team with more players on it. So we travel around in different groups, but wearing that USA jersey and expecting fully by my senior year, I'm operating on all. I mean, I'm hitting on all cylinders, firing on all cylinders, and I'm at the absolute peak of my game. And, you know, as things happen, I was out there my one game in December of my senior year, and we're playing against St. Lawrence, and I was just getting a breakout pass from my defenseman out of the zone. And I took one step forward of my left skate, caught into a deep groove in the ice right when I got hit, and blew out my knee. And that was it. And so everything gone in a nanosecond, you know, the negotiations with the Bruins were off. I couldn't come back and keep playing with the Olympic team. It was rough. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I had a lot of debt. I had student debt. I had credit card debt. I mean, I had fully expected to be signed to a pro contract and to be continuing my hockey journey. And that ended in literally in a nanosecond. So, but I was, I had gotten traded to New York, to the Rangers. And I tried the best I could to recover and play, but it just was futile. I needed to be like 110% to get to the NHL, and I was about 85. So yeah, I just wasn't going to get there. But I stayed in New York, and I knew some guys from Yale who had played hockey or football or basketball before me. And some people who weren't in sports at all that were in, they were in Wall Street, and they were doing, you know, various things, whether it was investment banking or institutional trading or something. And I wound up getting picked up by this British investment bank called SG Warburg. And they were doing something that was super mathematical, that where you trade foreign shares on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and you create the foreign shares from maybe the London Exchange or the Aussie Exchange, something, and then you convert them and trade them on the New York Exchange and sell them to U.S. customers. And so there's a conversion, there's a stamp tax, and you know, the currency and all that. And so I got hired to do that on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And that was my first job. And that's how I started out in Wall Street and in institutional investing. That was my first taste of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a difficult time in your life. There is, there's all sorts of stories. I mean, I think of my cousin at this point. He was a huge rugby union player as a teenager. Yeah. And all he wanted to do was play professional. And it turned out that he was a little too small and he got injured.
He didn't want to be a hedge fund manager?
Nah, he didn't want to be a hedge fund manager. Definitely not. That was his last, that would be his last port of call. But the step to elite sport is massive. And it's incredibly challenging. And then when you see these professionals that remain at the top of elite sport for like decades, is even more extraordinary. And some of it comes down to luck, right? If that rut hadn't been in the ice when it was, then maybe things would have been different. Who knows? How did you feel at that time? Like and what I'm intrigued by here is like, if you're into elite sport, like you were, you know, you're fiercely competitive, that you have to be, right? You're also, you know, a great athlete. What does it feel like to suddenly have all of those dreams just crumble like straight away?
You know, I mean, truthfully, I felt lost. I just felt like I had lost so much of my identity. I fully expected to be there. I had friends who were there. I had players who I played with, and I fully expected that was going to be my life. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And so, and to be truthful, I was scared. Even though I had this great degree, I finished college. I got my degree, and you know, I knew that I had something that would be worth something. But you know, this is back in 1994 now, and there were not a lot of jobs out there. I mean, I looked in Boston, Atlanta. I looked out in California. I looked in Chicago, any place, Dallas. There were not a lot of jobs. So, really the only place in the United States that was hiring in with my kind of skill set was New York City. And so I go into the city, poor, you know, young kid sleeping on friends' sofas, trying to figure out what to do. I was scared to death. And, but I also felt really fortunate, Jake, because I had gotten that education. And I had something that was a pretty solid safety net to fall back on. And so I was definitely fortunate that I had that, and that I parlayed. And I've got to give my dad a lot of credit for that, because he insisted, he was a nuclear engineer for many years in Navy nuclear. And he designed steam turbines for the submarines in the US Navy. And so, smart guy, really mathematical guy, but he was adamant that I was going to get an education. I wasn't just going to go and get a scholarship somewhere where I may or may not get an education. I may or may not have something to fall back on, because he knew that something could happen any moment. And sure enough, there it was. So, but I go to New York, both scared and hungry. I mean, I was devastated. but I wanted nothing more than to bounce right back and to figure something out that I could do and apply all that energy, all that focus, all of that hope back into. And so when I found institutional investing and trading, in particular at that time it was trading, I felt like it was perfect for me. It was fast paced. It was super competitive. It was actually super stressful because you're trading huge amounts of money. I mean, millions of dollars immediately out of the gate as a, 22-year-old kid. And so, your adrenaline is up. You have to think quickly. You have to react quickly. And if you make a mistake, you have to just move on rapidly and fix it and keep going. So it was really like professional sports in a way, or at least high level sports in that way. So it served me well, and it helped dig me out of that immediate emotional trench,
So important to have something to kind of refocus on, in a sense. When you first told me about, being in sport, and then some of your friends from that environment had ended up going into the investment world, I was struck by that kind of common phrase of, it's not necessarily what you know, it's who you know. But funny enough, the second part of your explanation for that is actually, if I was an employer and I was looking for some absolute hustlers to come and join me on my team, well, actually, someone who's got a point to prove, who was very nearly an elite sports player, is just the kind of character that you're looking for. And that's not about who you know, that's about who you are, right?
And absolutely.
Your university so degree and your attitude, and you were bang up for it. Fucking bring it on. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. And that's cool, because that's also great resilience as well, right? In a moment where, perhaps this has affected your investment strategy throughout your career. We'll get to that now. You had a future that you were absolutely certain was going to happen, and then it didn't. Mm-hmm. There was no backup plan, or not an immediate one. And that probably segues nicely then. So how did you find that experience then shaped you through the investment world, and teach me a little bit more about the 25 years you then spent there? Like, probably there's, it's a 3-hour long conversation, frankly, but just, some of the highlights, some of the difficult parts.
Well, I mean, just like you said, it's who you know, but that is true. There's no doubt about it. I was super fortunate that I had known some people who had forged a path for me and had a similar background and proven that, my kind of background would be applicable and would be a strength in that world. And so, I get down on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and that was trial by, baptism by fire. I mean, you were in, it's back in
Sink
the day
swim.
When it was chaos.
Wow.
I mean, the brokers running all over the place. It wasn't electronic. Everything was paper. You're calling brokers with a little, it's like a light board, and you just beep them in. They actually have physical beepers. You've got this board of lines in front of you that are just colored lights, and it's different desks calling from different places and in New York and around the world. And wow. You have to pick up them and just, you have to speak the language. And so that, immediately, that gave me a kick start. Like it was like a spark plug for my career, because I had the math skills. I had the, I could operate quickly in that environment because of all of that, high level competition. I was kind of used to it. I was comfortable. I was comfortable being outside of my comfort zone, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. And I was used to it. And so, just a short time later, maybe a year and a half later, I got a phone call from somebody who was looking for a trader on a hedge fund. And so it was with Travelers Group, and they were setting up a hedge fund in their Travelers Group unit. And so they had all these insurance premiums, like $80 billion, which now is nothing, but back then it was a big deal. It was a lot of money, and they needed to invest it. And so they started this hedge fund with $1 billion inside of it. And they needed somebody to help trade risk arbitrage and merger arbitrage, which again is a two-sided trade where you're, and we've said this word a lot. And so let me back up a little bit, arbitrage. So for your listeners, basically an arbitrage is actually capturing a true discrepancy between two securities. So one security is worth basically the same exact thing as another security. And if you buy one and short the other, you can capture that spread, that arbitrage between them. And so you can apply it to anything. You can do it with risk arbitrage, with different classes of securities. You can do it with convertible bonds and stock. You can do it with a stock that's going to be in a merger with another company. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can apply that. But if you understand it and you know how to do those calculations and you can do them quickly, well, then you can pretty much do any of them. So I got picked up by this unit at Travelers, and that was my first hedge fund job. And that was in New York City. And, you know, I did that for a couple of years, and I got, I was getting married in Texas. And so my first wife, and I invited a colleague to the wedding in Texas. And he said, well, I can't come, because he was already working in Texas. He said, I can't come, but I'm leaving my hedge fund to go start my own hedge fund. And they need somebody to do my job, which was exactly what I was doing. It was the head of the risk arbitrage unit. So I got hired at that firm down in Fort Worth, mm-hmm. out of New York City, which was another wild change. You know, I go from New York City kid, you know, this scrappy kid from New York City, and work in a hedge fund in Tribeca, down to Fort Worth. And suddenly it's slower pace. People are, you know, they're wearing boots and they're coming in shorts maybe. And it was just a completely different world. It was wild. I ended up staying in Texas for over 20 years. Wow. So yeah.
A couple of different hedge funds.
No. So fast forward, I had my own hedge fund. Okay. So I had gotten an opportunity to partner with a billionaire.
Sorry, James, before we jump into that, I don't want to speed up. So you moved down to Texas. So how long did you work with that firm for? And then eventually you then went to start your own thing?
Yeah, so I was there. I was with that firm, Carlson Capital, for about 5 years.
Okay.
And you know, it was great. I mean, we had grown huge, and the head of the firm was just, he was a master at getting investors comfortable with him. I mean, he was a very low risk guy. And so we didn't make massive returns, but we never lost big money. I mean, when I was there, we never lost money. Over the 5 years, we were always profitable.
Impressive.
True arbitrage, you know? I mean, you're not going to make a 2 or 3x in 1 year, but you're never going to lose money either. And that was a huge trade-off for investors. Like, yeah, sure. If you can make, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20%, we'll take that all day long, as long as you're not going to lose money. Yeah, that's a great return. So he grew really rapidly. I did well with them, but then I got an opportunity. I got an opportunity to open up a hedge fund seeded by this really wealthy guy in Dallas. And I did that. And unfortunately, Jake, I did it right when interest rates were coming back down. So they were up over 5%. It was after the bubble and interest rates are all.
So roughly when was it you started your own thing? Sorry,
back in 2002.
Okay.
And so you know, the washout already occurred from the collapse of the internet bubble, and so I got in, and interest rates, they just collapsed. And unfortunately, when you're in arbitrage, you really need interest rates to be higher in order to ensure a spread. Everything is keyed off of interest rates. You've seen me post about this. You've probably heard me talk about this, but you know, that Fed funds rate really sets the stage for every single financial instrument out there. And that is unfortunately, when that collapses down to zero, there's very little opportunity for arbitrage. And so once that happened, we knew it wasn't going to work. I mean, I put my heart and soul into that opportunity, and I was burned out. And so I stepped away. And so now I'm reformed. So
it's, starting your own thing is a huge challenge. And sometimes it isn't about the capital you raise. Sometimes it isn't about the team that you pull together. Sometimes it's not, you know, initial idea is a problem. The market can go against you. And that's exactly macro what you're describing, right?
So
2002, you started that. You spent, 2 years or so having a crack and it didn't work out or something?
Yeah.
And so where did that take you to next? So you were still in Texas at that point?
So I was still in Texas. At that point, I had moved to Dallas. The firm had moved to Dallas. So I'm in Dallas now. And I have a colleague that is at a family firm in Fort Worth. And he asked me to come help him set up this kind of a complicated structure in his firm. And it was a hybrid hedge fund private equity unit. And so I helped him do that and just stayed on as a COO. And I've been doing that for the last 15 years. That's done well. But you know, flash forward, now I have kids, I'm remarried. My wife is actually, she lives in Las Vegas at this time, right? And she's born and raised in Las Vegas. She's an author. She's a novelist, actually. And so we could go, she could work anywhere. And she was under contract at the time with HarperCollins. And so it didn't matter. She was just writing. She could run her laptop in the airport. It didn't matter. And so we went back and forth. I'd go there on weekends. She'd come to Dallas during the week. But Jake, flash forward to 2020, and I've got one kid off to college. My second one's about to go. And so I'm not sure, you know, what we're going to do yet, whether I'm going to move to Fort Worth we weren't sure what was going to happen, but we go into lockdown. And unfortunately, my wife and I got locked down in separate cities for 100 days.
Wow.
And so it was brutal. And my daughter was heading off to college, and I was like, okay, that's it. I packed up my car and drove out to Las Vegas and sold my house. And basically I just, you know, I had the conversation with my managing partner, and we just said, you know, it's what it is. My family's out here now. I've got a stepdaughter out here, and this is where we're at. And so we've agreed to replace me. And so we've been working on that for the last year, and we're getting to the end of that. And then, you know, the rest is history. But that brings us all the way to your next question.
I don't want to brush over this too much, because there's no doubt that the last 24 months has been an extraordinary experience for all of us. You know, Melbourne was locked down for 300 days. We weren't even allowed out of our house at points. It was just extraordinary. Insane. You see what's happening in Shanghai right now.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa. Yeah. And I think it's for all of us. So you mentioned you've really only been close to the Bitcoin space in the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. I was lucky to buy some 2015, but nice. I didn't understand how important it was until the last 24 months. And most of what I bought in 2015, I sold in 2016 and sold in 2017. So I was still sitting on about 25% of my original purchase. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, I'm like, holy shit, look how valuable this stuff is. And I've been looking at, you know, different ways of protecting wealth long term. And suddenly it all seems to just fall into place. But a lot of that has happened because of this macro scenario in terms of how badly affected our lives have been, you know. Where's your water coming from? Where's your food coming from? Where's your family? Oh, don't know. Whoa, this is crazy. I, you know, you suddenly outsourced your whole life. And it really makes you ask some tough questions. So, so you moved to Vegas, basically, is what you're saying through this process. You're like, fuck it, pack the car up, sell the house.
I was like, I'm not going. Other than the job, there was no reason for me to be there. And this is the kind of firm, and most people ask, well, why don't you just work remotely? It's just not that kind of firm. I mean, it's a very...
culturally, that happens sometimes, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's fine. And so, but, you know, flash forward, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. Now I know that I'm leaving that investment firm, and I'm not sure do I want to go start my own fund again? Do I want to, you know, buy a business here in Las Vegas? I mean, I don't really want to own a restaurant, you know? I mean, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. But then my son, who is in college. He's at Cornell, and he's surrounded by super smart guys. And they actually have their sciences and math are pretty top notch. Their engineering, computer science, and so he's surrounded by these kids who are talking about blockchain and you know, digital protocols. And he calls me. He's like, "Dad, if you don't know what you're going to do, you've got to dig into Bitcoin. So or dig into digital currencies." Okay, now I had already been in. I had already tried looking into them once. So let's. My Bitcoin journey in particular.
Sure, let's go with that. Yeah.
Extraordinarily painful. I mean, and it's humiliating. It's embarrassing, but it'll give you insight into what kind of hurdles we're up against. Just what kind of mountain we have to climb with institutional investors. So back in 2018, 2019, I was looking at, I had some discretionary capital. I wanted to invest in something that was a little bit further out in the risk curve, you know, something that I wasn't really sure about that I knew had a much higher risk reward profile, you know, a much higher binary profile, not a risk reward profile, but a much higher binary profile than my typical investments that I was looking for. And so Bitcoin came up on my radar, and I did what most you know, 99.9% of institutional investors do. And they go and talk to the analysts who are in our industry, right? So, but when you talk to a technology analyst already in this world, the institutional investing world, at that time, nobody understood it. Nobody understood what Bitcoin was. And so I was warded off it immediately. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's not, it doesn't have any fundamental value. There's nothing supporting it, you know, just stay away. And so Bitcoin, $3,500, I walked away, didn't buy any. And so I never looked at it again. I was just like, okay, well, it's just one of those crazy things. And so then we go into lockdown. Then when my son calls me, he's like, "You've got to look back into these digital protocols." And so of course he convinced me to buy some Ethereum. And, you know, so I buy some Ethereum. And I start digging into these different cryptocurrencies, and Bitcoin, it comes up on my radar again. And I start listening to different podcasts and start reading different things that are outside of Bloomberg or the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times, you know, and start digging into articles and into pieces, reading the white paper. And I mean, it took me about 2 or 3 weeks to get out of Ethereum and all into Bitcoin, you know? Whew. So, but I was watching this, there was that aha moment, you know, I was watching the Michael Saylor videos, and he's a little bit out there talking about the everything is energy and money is really just, it's just encapsulated energy and captured and, you know, stored. And yeah, I get all of that. Great. But what really got me was I was listening to an interview with Jeff Booth, and he was talking with Pomp. And I listened to that interview and how he's talking about the barbell of inflationary versus deflationary pressures, and how they're colliding, and how the monetary system is not set up to handle that for much longer. And it's becoming this force that's going to be explosive. And at the end of his book, he talks about how the answer to that is Bitcoin. Now I've had dinner with him actually last week, when out at the Bitcoin conference. And, you know, he said he actually wrote that. And as he was writing it all, that became the obvious conclusion. He didn't write it with the point of leading people to Bitcoin. He wrote it because of this truth that he saw and how there's a problem with our monetary system. And then it just, I think he had his own aha moment as I understood it when we were talking, and he was like, "Yes, Bitcoin is the answer." And of course, now, you know, Jeff, he's one of the best, biggest proponents on stage about Bitcoin. And so, but that clicked with me. I read his book. Then I went and read the Bitcoin Standard and a few other, the Bitcoin books. And that's what really solidified it for me. And I've been doing nothing but in the investment world, doing nothing but researching and talking to people about Bitcoin, about the technology, about the network, about the mining opportunities, about, you know, just how it all works. And really myself applying all of that macro knowledge and all of that investment knowledge, that institutional investment knowledge to the space and trying to bridge that gap. And so that's kind of where I'm at now.
It's awesome. I'm so glad you're at it. Like someone like yourself that's been on this incredible journey already sees the value proposition. And, you know, explaining to people why there is even a value proposition in the first place is a massive part of this process. But
absolutely,
you mentioned that your Bitcoin journey was humiliating. I think it may feel like that, but from my perspective, there is a proof of work there. You know, that gets to the very like bottom of what Bitcoin is. Like, we've all fucked around in altcoins doing different stuff. We've all made, you know, other different investments. We've sold at the wrong time. We bought at the wrong time. You know, We sent some to someone. I bought a 1980s Mercedes SL, like classic car in 2018 with Bitcoin Cash that I got from the hard fork. You know, I could have had double the Bitcoin stack if I hadn't done that. But I went and bought a classic car that I sold 3 months later because it was an absolute pile of junk, you know, like just stupid stories. Like they're kind of like battle scars in a sense on the way to that moment where you go, oh, this is interesting. And The Price of Tomorrow, Jeff Booth's book, is fantastic. I recommend it to everyone. Yeah. I have a YouTube channel that I set up with some mates previously, and we interviewed Jeff, and his story is amazing. And in particular, it's that fact that he's been an entrepreneur. And he's worked very closely with the technology space for a long time. He's an angel investor in like hundreds of early stage companies. And so if anyone out there is going to understand technology's potential, it's someone like him. And it's that blend that he brings to the table when you go, that's really bloody interesting. Okay. And like I mentioned before, like leveraging other people's experience or insights is totally fine, right?
Absolutely.
One thing I wanted to mention, James, is I believe you're involved in a project called Looking Glass Education with Daz.
That's right.
Daz has been one of my guests on the show already, a couple of episodes before. Yeah. So
super smart guy. Super smart.
What a hero.
You
know, his passion for grassroots financial education is not just infective, it's also it's driven from a place of like genuine requirement. You know, he looked at his life. He couldn't understand why he never had any money, never had any time, never had any money. He's like, what the fuck am I going to do about this? And then boom, down this big, like, you know, 5-year rabbit hole of hunting for financial freedom and teaching people how they can potentially do it. And it's an awesome story. Perhaps James, you could talk a bit more to, you know, it's now 20 years down the line since 2002, when you first attempted to go out and do something on off your own bat, the projects you're going to be involved in going forward. So I'd love to know a bit more about them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I mean, one of those, and you mentioned mining perhaps.
You
only mentioned what you're allowed to. Nothing needs to be, you know, private information that you release or whatever, but I'd love to see where's this rabbit hole taking you over the next few years?
Yeah. So the Looking Glass is great. I mean, what happened there is what I had befriended and been talking to Greg Foss quite a bit. And so we talk all the time. And so that is an obvious link. I mean, he traded risk. He'll tell you ad nauseum, right? That he traded risk in the debt chair for many years. And so our thought process, the way we see the world, the way we see Bitcoin is extremely similar. You know, so we both look at it as the ultimate insurance against a fiat collapse. I mean, that's where I got to. And so with our thinking is kind of, it dovetails together. I mean, I come from mostly equity, the equity world, and he comes from all debt, the debt world. But we still look at it and think, you know, if fiat collapses, this is the ultimate insurance against it, and you better own some. And so, but anyway, so he and I had talked quite a bit about it and quite a bit about that, you know, that reality for us. And he told me he was working on this project with these guys and you know, it's Daz and it's Seb Bunny. And it's also a guy named Jason Sansoni, who's a, so Seb is the, he's kind of the, he and Daz are leading the charge, the effort to actually build this out and create it. And then, you know, Jason is, he's an older guy, like not quite my age. Definitely not Greg's. We're going to call Greg the old guy here. So, you know, those guys are leading the charge with creating the content and putting it together, making it all accessible and simple. And then you've got Greg and me and Jason's kind of, we're definitely contributing, but we're more on the advisory than the actual day-to-day operation. I mean, they're the workhorses and they should get all the credit, truly. So, but Greg pulled me in, and so, and these guys are brilliant. They're great guys. And so what the platform is meant to do is be an introduction to finance, money, and all of the issues that we talk about all day long on Twitter and in podcasts that people aren't exposed to. And it's set up in a way where it's actually a course where it's you go through the course and you complete these different steps. And the further you go down that rabbit hole, the more it builds on itself and the more knowledge you have. And, you know, you eventually get to the Bitcoin reality and how that fixes so many of the issues that we have in the fiat world. But the beauty of it is it's set up just like a course that you would take in a college, and you go through each module and at your own pace and learn as you go. And then if you want to dig a little bit deeper or have a deeper dive on something, you can go into a different section where, you know, you've got one-off deep dives. Some of that is the stuff that I write. And we're using a lot of the newsletter that I have, the informationist newsletter that I have. We're using a lot of that material on there too. So people can just go directly in there and see what a CDS is, you know, what the yield curve is, what CPI is, and really understand it. And so, and that stuff is my newsletter. And that's where I take something that's super complicated to the average person that they may not have ever been exposed to, but they hear all the time. They hear it on Bloomberg or CNBC, or they see it in the papers. Oh, the CPI is up. Well, what does that mean? I mean, if you haven't been in the business for 25 years, you may not know exactly what that means, or you may be confused on it. And there's a lot of disinformation. So I try to distill it down to something super simple and make it very easy for you to understand and come away feeling smarter and being empowered to make better financial decisions for yourself and for your family. And that's the whole point of it. And that's the whole point of the whole platform. So it kind of works together for all of us.
I love that phrase, you know, give a man a fish and he eats for a day, teach a man to fish and he feeds his family for life. It's such a powerful phrase that, you know, a good friend of mine is basically a self-taught trader, and he's done some awesome stuff in the last 2 or 3 years. Shout out to Jigsy if he's listening. And he loves that phrase. He absolutely loves it. It's a great phrase, one. Yeah. And what you guys are building there is that typifies that. And you're right. What is CPI? I mean, I understand it in a sense, but even someone who spent years looking at investing and went through a business school, like, have they changed how the CPI is calculated? Yes, they have.
Yes, they have.
Okay, so what if we go back to how they used to calculate it? Oh, well, actually, the number's different. And it's, yeah, I won't go down that kind of like irritating hole of like what's real and what's not real. But
right. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that everyday people, my wife says it. She used to say it all the time. She'd say, I knew that there's something that you guys know, that you guys have been taught in your jobs and in that world of institutional investing. And it's kind of a secret and nobody else knows it. You know, now the truth is it's not really, it's just, there's no program for us to go and teach people about it. And you're not learning it. You're definitely not learning it in American schools. No. You're not learning in college. You know, you're not learning these things, and you may learn some theories around it in business school or in, you know, some focused finance schools, but the reality is that you can't really learn this stuff until you've actually been doing it for a while. Mm-hmm. And then you can teach it in a different way. And so that's kind of where, you know, let's pull back the curtain. Let's show everybody who the wizard is, you know, let's show exactly what they're doing. And so you can understand it. It's not that difficult. It's just, we use a lot of fancy terms and we throw them around really rapidly. And the hard part is making the connection between those terms. Mm-hmm. And that's how it all comes together. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the point.
Cause in some ways, and it's a noble goal. It's something that people frankly absolutely need. And if they go and take the time to learn what you guys are offering them, they will benefit from it. Absolutely no doubt about it. What strikes me is actually fairly consistent across what I would now call like Bitcoin. It's like people who have got a significant amount of their personal wealth sitting in this cryptocurrency, hopefully in self-custody, and they understand, you know, that private property ownership has forever been changed by the profound nature of this innovation. But people take a while to get to that point. And I often feel like the type of character, as I said, he calls himself a Bitcoiner, they have quite a multidimensional skill set. And I don't want to call it a skill set. I'm just going to call it life, like experience set, mm-hmm. because they didn't specifically go out to learn these things. They just happened to have picked them up through their lifetime. And whether they're technologists and they understand the importance of anonymity and digital scarcity being invented, and they're like, holy shit, blockchain is fucking insane. And it really is just most applicable to this one specific innovation. Let's go focus there. Or whether someone more like myself, my father died as I was a young man, I inherited some money. I've been trying to solve the problem of wealth protection for 10 years. And frankly, it's fucking hard. Savings are not synonymous with investing. There's risks, but when you can't save because interest rates are where they are, you're forced to invest. And then, you know, like what happened to me this week, you end up in wealth management meetings and you basically get this portfolio of crap that you don't even know what these companies are doing or what. Like, I own some Chinese debt. Why in the fuck would I want Chinese debt? I've got 20% bonds in this portfolio. You're like, Jesus, guys, that's a 3% yield. You think CPI data is coming out 8.5%. If I don't believe CPI and I think it's more like 15% and 25% of dollars have been printed in the last like 4 years or 2 years or whatever it is, this is losing purchasing power and I'm paying you for it.
You know what? And the worst part about it is you've worked so hard to make money. You know, you only get paid in fiat at this point. Then you have to take that. That is storing your energy, right? That you've put out. You've put that energy out and you're getting reward for that, you know, that the use of that energy, exertion of that energy. And then you're forced to take risk to protect it. That's ludicrous. Absolutely insane that that's where we're at. And we've got everybody in the world believing that that's okay.
Yeah.
Except for Bitcoiners, of course,
yeah,
who are railing against it. So, but to your point, so now you've got a wealth manager who's got you in Chinese bonds. I mean, has anybody, you know, really thought through that, you know, and what 3% yield? I mean, like you said, you're losing probably 12% purchasing power annually on that.
The phrase that they used was that they were inflation protected bonds. So there might be some kind of product that something, but the point here is I'm not an institutional investor.
Yeah.
I don't understand exactly how the product works, but I'm forced to use a service like this. And this actually circles back nicely to the mountain that has to be climbed in the face of institutional investment and Bitcoin. This is a very recent experience I've had where I did it last year. I said, what do you guys think about inflation? Oh, it's not a problem. They open the meeting this year and they say, I had a look at our notes last year and inflation wasn't mentioned. Lie. It's the first thing I asked you about 12 months ago. So you've just lied at the start of the meeting. Cool. Good start. And this is with my family. So, you know, this is just my opinion and they have their own views. And it's a bit of a too many chefs in the kitchen in a sense, but it is what it is, and we'll work together to move forwards. But the way that this whole like charade gets played out is we are not in a place of understanding, and they sell themselves as being in this position of like, I understand mm-hmm. what's going on. So a year ago I said, inflation, is it a problem? I already knew it was, right? We know it's going to be a problem. And then here we are, it's transitory. Oh, now it's 8.5% official numbers. Yep. Real rates could be 20, who knows? Rough calculation would suggest 20-25%. And they then say, you're going to be lucky if we beat CPI this year. And you go, okay, so I'm losing purchasing power over time. And even then you go, okay, has your thinking evolved on Bitcoin? And I just left it open-ended. Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. And they go on this long-winded spiel about Putin and the problem with, like, you know, an unregulated network, and then talking about how they like the idea of CBTCs, and just, it was an absolute fucking car crash of a set of questions fire. From someone who's sitting in my yeah. seat, who's done the work yeah. to go, this system's collapsing, thanks Jeff Booth. And alongside that, we've got this new thing that's being built organically on a decentralized basis that we can own and no one else can take off us. Okay, cool. This is actually happening. And then you go up in meetings like that, and just, they're just light years away from deciding to go light down years. The hole even. So I don't want to talk too much about my problems, but the context is interesting, right? So that's just a recent experience I had. So from your mm-hmm. experience working in the industry for the last 20 odd years, how do you think Bitcoin is best sold to institutions or communicated yeah. to them, or how do you see that playing out? Because it's, you know, it's something we look to a lot, like, oh, this wave of institutional money's coming. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the market looks a bit bearish right now. We didn't hit the 150K that everyone expected, and maybe they haven't no. done. So what's going to happen, do you think?
So first of all, I, you know, in fairness to your to your asset allocators, to your managers, I would not want to be an asset allocator today. Yeah, this is a very difficult environment. Very difficult. I mean, you and I can talk offline what I think that you might want to be doing instead, you mm-hmm. know, and give you some ideas. But look, the thing is with institutional investors is it takes them a long time to understand it. Okay. They have this barrage of information coming at them about cryptocurrencies and about regulations, about possible regulations, about China, banning Bitcoin, about Bitcoin using too much energy, which we know is just a lie, that it's just absurd. You know, they're just confused. They get hit with so much noise and it's difficult to find the signal, right? So, but let's pretend that they're smart enough to know to find it, because I think a lot of them are. It's just that, quite honestly, the system for them has worked. They don't need a new system. It's been working happy. Just fine for them. They're happy with the way it's working. You think Jamie Dimon wants a new system? Hell no. It's the last thing he wants. He wants a system that working for him right now has always worked for him and worked for all his CEO buddies and for all of his, you know, managing partners and directors and all the different entities that he's involved with personally and professionally. You know, they don't want a new system. They want this system. It works for them. So that's one thing. So you have to get over the hurdle of the selfishness and the obstinance of institutional investors just refusing to look at anything else because they don't need to. Mm-hmm. And they believe that this is all going to work out just fine. And you know what? In their lifetime, it might. It might work out just fine for somebody who's 50, 60 years old. In their lifetime, it may just be just fine for the next 10 or 25 years, you know? And it may get worse. But on the other hand, it may collapse quickly and we don't know when. So let's pretend though that they do take a real look at it. They don't listen to their technology analysts. They actually start reading things. They read the white paper. They read the price of tomorrow. They read the Bitcoin standard. They read layered money, you know, and they start really digging into and accumulating knowledge, true knowledge about Bitcoin itself and what it really is. The actuality of this immutable, scarce resource that is as close to as perfect money as we've ever created on this planet. And they realize it and they buy into it. They understand it. You have one portfolio manager who does that. Now they're at an institution. So The problem is they have to then get the chief investment officer to buy into it. And then they've got to get their board of directors to buy into it. And then they've got to get their chief compliance officer to buy into it. Then they've got to get their compliance team to buy into it. Then they've got to get their operations team up to speed onto it. Then they've got to get the on-ramps. Like, who's going to, how are they going to buy it? What exchange are they going to buy it on? And is it regulated enough for them to use for an institutional product? Where are they going to settle it? Who's going to custody it? Are they going to have it in cold storage? Are they going to have it on an exchange somewhere with a large bank? Because these guys use something that's called a prime broker. They don't have a broker like you and me. They have a broker that actually custodies all their assets for them and uses certain leverage for that. Then what's the leverage factor? How does that impact their margin? How does it impact, you know, their borrowing capacity? And then, you know, after you get through all of that, how do you market? How do you market day to day? I mean, it doesn't close. Do you market at midnight in London? Do you market on the New York close? I mean, so these are all of the questions they have to go through before they can buy it. And that just takes months. Forget about days, forget about weeks. It takes months. And it could take 8, 9, 10, 12 months for them to get through all of that red tape and bureaucracy to the point where they can actually pull the trigger and buy some. Now, here's the good news. So let's say that they do get past zero and they know that they're going to buy some. Well, it's a huge institution. They've got billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Who knows? And they want an allocation. Well, they're going to say they need a 1%, 2%, 3% allocation, whatever it is. Let's just say they take a 1% allocation and they need to buy $100 million worth. Okay. Well, they're not going to look at it and say, well, you know, it's $67,000. I'm going to wait until it comes back to 55. They're going to say, okay, buy 10% of the position right here. And then wherever it is, they're going to continue buying it. They may just say, you know what, buy half it here and we'll buy the rest later as the price goes. But they're going to participate. They're not going to be waiting for prices. They're going to participate where the price is. Mm-hmm. And they do that because it's a cover your ass strategy. They want to be able to say, hey, look, we got the best, we got the market price. We participated at the market. That's what the market price was. That's where we bought it. They're not going to go out on a limb and say, well, we're waiting for the price. That's nonsense. They're going to buy it. And if you get a lot of institutional investors that start buying rapidly and all at the same time, that's where we enter price discovery. We'll have a decoupling of the asset from risk assets, and it will actually find true price discovery where it'll enter price discovery where these guys aren't caring where they buy it at what price. They just know they need a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% allocation to it. That's all they know. And that's when it takes off. And at that point, God help you if you don't have any.
It's a wonderful explanation. Good. It's a fortunate piece of context I had there to start that off. I loved it. to your point, essentially, it's all very well going into an asset allocator meeting and complaining about CPI and asking them about Bitcoin. They might own it personally, but getting it through all of the required due diligence to invest on behalf of a family, different ballgame. And you explained very, very nicely as to why that's actually hard. And to be fair, it's helped tempered my displeasure with the meeting I had earlier this week and gone, do you know what? Fair enough. You have a point. And it's, you know, this is the exciting thing. On my own book, I can get into Bitcoin, right? I see the opportunity. So if this actually goes the way that we think it might go, it doesn't really matter what those asset allocators are doing, frankly.
That's right.
Wow.
Until it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Until it does. And that's a really exciting moment, this whole idea of decoupling from other assets and true price discovery kicking in, because it's something that has really never happened before, as far as I know, where the average guy on the street is front running the smartest money in the world.
That's right.
Holy fucking shit. Yeah. What does that
that's
mean?
Right.
And you go, okay, we know all these guys are interested and they've got way more money than we can ever dream of.
Yeah.
And even when they do arrive, they're just going to buy it. They don't care if it's like all-time high. They're just going to get it.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Whoa. So, you know, if you look at, I think eventually this becomes just pure money. It becomes a global reserve asset, mm-hmm. and then the global reserve currency. Okay. But let's just start with the investment world that we're talking about, right? So just the investment world. Now, Greg uses a different number, and I get you know, tagged on this all the time, but he and I talk about it all the time because he's looking even further out. I'm just saying, like, right now, let's look at where we are right now and the conversation you and I are having about the institutional world, the institutional investors coming into this space. Okay. So what's the total addressable market for Bitcoin? For investments, let's just say that about 3 or 4 months ago, these are the right numbers, and they're close enough. So let's just use the round numbers.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's just say you have $140 trillion worth of investable bonds in the world, $120 trillion of stocks, equities. You've got $300 trillion of real estate. That's going to go down now with interest rates going up. Let's just use that number for the moment, right? $300 trillion. You've got $30 trillion of art and collectibles. You've got another $10 trillion of gold. Then you've got M2, which is just cash, savings, money market accounts, liquid investments that are basically cash equivalent. That's another $130 trillion. So you're looking at $730 trillion of investable assets in the world. Now, if Bitcoin just takes 1% of that, just 1%, you're looking at about a $350,000 Bitcoin. If you have 2%, that's $700,000 Bitcoin. 3% is over $1 million of Bitcoin. Just think about that. So, and that's just the investment universe. You know, there's a lot of things that could happen. You get some clarity on regulation. You get a cash ETF, you know, a spot ETF instead of a futures ETF. You have the things that we're talking about with institutional investors gaining comfort, and you get some widespread knowledge and understanding and approvals for them to go ahead and buy it. I mean, you get we go through this period of choppiness with the Fed and we come out the other side. Like, all these things could converge. And then you start talking about these asset allocators and that's what we're looking at. So when you think about a 1% allocation, that's almost a 10 times return from here, right? $350,000 Bitcoin, and that's for 1%. So
amazing, isn't it?
Right.
And so, James, so I've been an avid reader of your newsletter, and you talk about risk reward in that really succinctly. I enjoyed it a lot. So just to my very basic understanding, you know, the risk today is we're at $40,000. It could go to zero. So you've lost 40 grand, or it could half in value. So you've lost 20 grand versus a 3% of total investable assets, $1 million Bitcoin. You know, this is a 20X from where we are today. Can you talk a little bit about how risk reward you view assets and why Bitcoin's so exciting?
Yeah, actually, I mean, like, if you look at it right here, okay, and let's just say that you use let's say you use an 80% drawdown, which is kind of the thing that people like to point to with Bitcoin, an 80% drawdown from the all time high, which would be from 69,000, it would get you about a $14,000 Bitcoin, right? So, you know, if you use your 3% total addressable market of global investment assets, that's $1 million. So at $40,000 Bitcoin, we're kind of where we're at right now. Your downside is about like 0.65x, right? But your upside is 25x. So that's a 38-to-1 risk reward. That is absolutely compelling from here. If you look at it another way, you know, you say, and this is the calculation that Greg and I use all the time, is using $1 million Bitcoin target, you know, and just like a simple binary probability analysis. I mean, in reality, you would do these in layers and you do a number of them together, but just to keep it simple, at $40,000, if your upside is $1 million, you know, the market is telling you that there's a four, and you assume that it could go to zero, not 14,000. Let's just make it worst case, you know, it goes to zero. The market's telling you that there's a 4% probability that it goes to $1 million. That's 40,000 divided by a million is 4%. So do you think that there's a 96% probability that Bitcoin goes to zero? Or do you think that there's a higher than 4% probability that Bitcoin goes to a million? If you do, then you need to be buying some here. Just on an investment opportunity, that's what that is telling you. And that has nothing to do with the ultimate insurance against fiat collapse. That's just on an investment basis and using a simple probability analysis. So it is the most positive, amazing, asymmetric opportunity for investment that I have ever seen. And I can't get over the fact that it's still sitting here.
It's amazing, isn't it? And that detracts, or not detracts, but disguises. There's two ways I want to go here. No, let's go in this direction. So, okay, risk reward, great analysis. Thank you. Last kind of more, or let's say impactful theory that you were helping to teach was around tailwind risks. Mm-hmm. And this is really around the collapse of fiat currency. So could you just talk us through a little bit about what that means and the bell curve graph you've sent out before? And it's really just like what happens in the worst case scenario.
So, I mean, if you think about it, in the worst case scenario, and all fiat currencies collapse, and Bitcoin just, it just eats every single asset out there as far as being the base currency for it, right? So if you don't own any Bitcoin now, you know, all your assets are going to be, let's just pretend that you have a catastrophic fiat collapse. We go into a debt spiral. The confidence in all of the fiat currencies just evaporates, and people buy Bitcoin with absolute abandon, right? Well, obviously Bitcoin is going to go well beyond $1 million. It's going to go up to $10 million per coin. I mean, who knows?
And even if we predict a crazy number today, we'll be undercooking it by 100x or something. We don't understand exponential like very well, and we don't understand like genuine global stampede of like 9 billion people. Like, it's going to be theoretically crazy, but
So if you think about that, right, and you have all you need to do is have 1% of your net worth in Bitcoin. Okay, so you take all of your investments, your stocks, your gold, your real estate, your collectibles, anything you have. Maybe you only have stocks, you know, maybe you only have some cash, but you take just 1% of that and you put it into Bitcoin. Okay. And 99% of your stuff is in your net worth is in everything else. Your house minus your mortgage, your stocks, your 401k or your IRA, like all of that added up, that's 99%. And you only have 1% in Bitcoin. If you have a catastrophic collapse and all of fiat just evaporates and Bitcoin eats all of it, well, Bitcoin's going to go up 100 times from here. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It's going to be worth 100 times more than it is today. So that 1% is your insurance contract. It's basically like Greg calls it a CDS. He's basically likening it to a credit default swap on the bonds, the whole bond universe. But in this scenario, it's kind of a credit default swap on all fiats. So if the fiats collapse, your credit default swap of your Bitcoin becomes worth hundreds of times what it is today, right? So your whole portfolio is saved. In fact, you'll probably make money. You'll probably end up better on the other side if you have 1% of your net worth in Bitcoin, if we have a complete collapse. And so what I tell people is, you know, they think, well, that's never going to happen. That's never going to happen in the United States. It just won't happen. Well, look at what happened in Venezuela. And I wrote a thread about that. You're right. About how you walk into a coffee shop, you order your main dish, and by the time you get to you know, or go into a restaurant and you order your main dish, and by the time you get to your dessert and coffee, they've changed the chalkboard because it's a different price, because the currency is moving so rapidly. I mean, we're talking about it's moving, you know, 50, 100, 200% monthly. I mean, it's moving a dozen percent sometimes a day. And that's just insanity. And yes, that could happen. What happens is people lose confidence in the government backing it, and they don't want to own it. And they sell anything that's denominated in it with abandon and get out of that currency. And it just, it collapses. And we've seen it happen to every single fiat currency in history.
It's crazy that, isn't it, as a fact, when you start learning about it, like every time this has been tried before, it failed.
Every time.
Name me a time when it didn't, you know. And if anything, it's...
I cannot.
I spent years in the startup space, and we were being coached to hunt for big problems to solve. And mm-hmm. the theory being, you know, find someone with an extremely acute problem, solve it with a digital tool. If you solve it, they'll pay you to solve it. And then you get your seed funding and boom, you're a VC-backed company and they want you to build a unicorn. I went through a number of, in hindsight, what are kind of elite talent investment programs, like technology accelerators. And it struck me only relatively recently, but man has had a problem forever. And that problem forever has been money. Because it has never, ever, ever, ever been out of the control in some way of a centralized party, ever.
Until it's always now. Been it's always been manipulated.
Correct.
And now you have Bitcoin.
Even really understood what that means. And yeah, of course, you know, maybe we're all wrong. Maybe Bitcoin is controlled by the NSA or Putin or you know, some other you know, incredible group of people that did this all on purpose to like trick us into using it. But it's an extraordinary moment when you suddenly realize that, isn't it? That for, I mean, so I'm 33 years old, my whole life I've been using a currency that actually is backed by nothing, absolutely nothing. And we're just, it's normal, you know, we trust it. It's like, but why do I trust it? And that's the whole rabbit hole. So yeah, James, listen, an hour or so has flown by. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
It's very clear to me, that you're passionate about this subject. And it comes through really brilliantly as we've had this discussion. And in just a short time, you know, you've made lots of great friends on Twitter. You're doing an awesome newsletter. And it's fascinating to me how, you know, we talk through risk reward. It's a very simple tool that you used in your 25 years of investing that when reapplied to Bitcoin, screams, look at this asset. And that's what I find so cool about these conversations, which is that was your journey to this space and you understand it through that lens, but other people have different reasons for being here and Bitcoin solves different problems for different people and the journeys they've been on help all of us to understand really what we're dealing with here. So thank you so much for sharing all of those insights and stories. Just lastly, James, where can people get hold of you if they're interested in what you're up to, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, you have a newsletter that I've subscribed to. And so that's, you're being very modest, but you have a great newsletter as well. So
thank you.
I appreciate it. And, you know, and we have the same passion. We want to educate people, you know, I mean, I want to reach people and make them smarter and make them and empower them. So, you can hear me rant or I don't really rant. I'm actually, I would say that I'm a pretty even tempered guy on
Twitter. Yeah, I wouldn't say you're a ranter, but after this experience.
Yeah.
Maybe get a few whiskeys in you and see what happens.
I haven't done that yet. It's a heel bloom, right? So no, you can find me on Twitter. It's just at James Lavish. And then I've got in my Twitter, you can see both the educational platform, lookingclasseducation.com. That's in there. And then also my newsletter and that newsletter comes out every Sunday morning and it's one very, very, simple. It's a simplified, discussion about a complicated topic. And so, that's it. And simple as that. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, James, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Jake. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.